But that's from 1962, and we're talking here about how I learned to stop worrying and love the Beach Boys, and that, oddly enough, in my personal journey with the Beach Boys, I never listened to what they had produced in 1962, which was their first year, really, of recording, until last year, and I've been a major fanatical fan for a long time, and then this is a group and it's a subject for me that has never stopped bearing fruit. And there seems to be a well that it just continues to yield water. And so there I am at the only period I'd ever written off of theirs. And I like the stuff from the 80s. I like the stuff from the 90s. I like the stuff that's, you know, I like the stuff that they did last year. The only period I'd never gone to is 1962. So I thought it was a kind of an interesting way to start. And of course, that is an extremely sad song. And Brian Wilson, one of the themes that we'll discuss here in some length, is the extreme melancholy that was being communicated under the guise of a fun in the sun, surfing USA mentality and sort of aesthetic. One of the things that you find out about the Beach Boys. Actually, let's backtrack. I'm going to start with a bit of scripture, because this is a Christian conference, after all. From 2 Corinthians 12, 9 through 10. But he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, and difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong." We've been talking a lot about weakness and suffering and guilt and pain, and you may feel like that you're just tired and you want to go take a nap. The reason I scheduled this session for this hour was because we can also have a whole lot of fun with the subject of suffering. as fun as weird as that sounds, I think that's true. In weakness, in melancholy, there's a lot of joy and a lot of fun to be had, and for me, that means talking about the Beach Boys. So, that's the kind of thematic verse to go from. So, who are Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys? Who is Brian Wilson? The Beach Boys are from, they were formed in 1961 in Hawthorne, California. It was the three Wilson brothers and their cousin Mike. Mike Love is his last name, which is a very ironic thing. One of the many ironies of the Beach Boys is that his last name is Love. You'll find out in this minute. And their friend from school named Al Jardine, who kind of looks like a little elfish character. And I've got some books that I passed around that have some incredible photos of the Beach Boys throughout the years. These are guys that have done more for facial hair in this country than, like, anything. And you think of the Beach Boys as this clean-cut group, and it's really scrubbed. But the Beach Boys, from basically the majority of their career, and I'm talking about from 1967 until 1988, all had beards. All had beards. If you want to find something cool online, you can go to beachboysbeards@tumblr.com. And it's nothing but pictures of the incredible facial hair that the Beach Boys had throughout the years. These guys were just unbelievably gifted in that area. So anyway, but they were formed in Hawthorne, California, which is a suburb of L.A., in 1962. It's a little strange because Hawthorne is now almost entirely Latino. And if you go there, there's a Beach Boys monument. But it's in the middle of basically like what feels like a little bit of a barrio. You know, there's dissonance. But that's just the context of what they were living in. They were these are Scotch-Irish. Ethnically, these guys were brought up Presbyterian, believe it or not. And that's one of the reasons I find them interesting. No one ever talks about the fact that they sort of are representative of a sort of kind of 50s Protestant ideal of America that no longer really exists and probably didn't even exist then. But that's how they were portrayed, at least that's how they were sold. The Beach Boys were formed by this family, and therefore there's a lot of dynamics going on because it's a family. Three brothers. I mean, think of the rivalries. Brian was the oldest. Then there was Dennis, who was the middle one. He's the one who drowned. Another irony of the Beach Boys story. He drowned in 1982 or 84, I forget. 83. And then there was Carl, who was the youngest. And sort of if you look at pictures of them, he's this sort of pudgy one. But he's the one with the most angelic voice. He's the one that sang God Only Knows. So that's how you know the three Beach Boys. And then there's Mike Love, who's their cousin. Let's go, sir. He's the one with the nasally voice. He had the least range and couldn't play any musical instruments. But he's known as a world-class pain in the neck, shall we say. But he has made it his business to keep the Beach Boys going, so I have to love him in a certain way. They are the best-selling popular American rock and roll group of all time. They have just because of that length of career, they're celebrating their 50th year in sort of since their first single, they're celebrating their 50th year this past year, and so they've been on a tour. In classic Beach Boys fashion, it just ended by Mike Love firing Brian Wilson and not telling him until Brian had to find it out in the papers, even though they were playing every night. I mean, this is the sort of stuff these people do to each other. They are crazy. So one thing you have to get, you have to understand from the beginning in talking about the Beach Boys, they're insane. They're insane. And if you think about it seriously, to record three straight records that were only about surfing, and then two straight records that were only about drag racing, the obsessiveness involved in that kind of focus is just not something you see every day. I mean, what if you were to record a record and you decided every single song was going to be about accounting? You know, I mean, that's a bad, maybe you really like woodworking and you liked it so much that you wanted to talk about it nonstop. That's what these guys are like. So anyway, Brian Wilson is the oldest of the Beach Boys. He is the tall, sort of, if you look at their early videos, and I was going to try to show some videos, but I'm not going to. He's very awkward looking. He's kind of rotund. This is one of the many things to love about the Beach Boys. They were not good looking. One of them was good looking, and his name was Dennis. And he was a notorious Lothario. He was married 9 times. His final wife was Mike Love's daughter. So just bear that in mind as we continue. It's one of the great, beautiful ironies of American, the popular landscape, that the Beach Boys have one image, and the reality is so completely different. And yet that image is also kind of true, because they did write those songs about drag racing and fun in the sun. So, Brian is—he's considered a bit of a genius, and I think he is a genius. Brian Wilson was—he's completely self-taught. He's deaf in one ear. He can only hear out of one ear. That's why all of their early songs, and in fact, continuing on for a long time, was everything was mixed in mono. Even after stereo sound separation and sort of balance of speakers and sounds like that, he was recording in mono. But Brian had no formal training. None of these guys have college educations. But they have made, again, some of the most beautiful and fascinating and frustrating and sensitive and insensitive, offensive music of the and wide-ranging music of the past 50 years. So, I was going to quote from my favorite essay about the Beach Boys is called In Praise of Mike Love, and I've reproduced it on Mockingbird. I liked it so much because it argues that Mike Love, he was balding by, this is, you know, in terms of their physical appearance, he was prematurely bald, so he was the one singing all those car songs, but he was wearing, like, ridiculous, like, page boy caps and things like that to hide his balding, and then he went through a Maharishi phase where he was wearing long, flowing robes on stage. He had a Martin Van Buren beard at one point and wore, union suits on stage. I mean, he had a great phase in the late 70s where he was wearing a glitter vest with no shirt on and a turban. Now, when you see him, he's got a baseball cap on and looks like somebody's granddad. But he is one of the craziest people in the world. I talked about their obsessiveness. I talked about, and both Brian and Mike were both, they were sort of, Mike was seen as the jock, and Brian was the sort of the sensitive soul. And the story about the Beach Boys, one of the reasons that initially drew me in, was that I felt like I was as a younger guy, I was more a sensitive person. Rock and roll was generally, especially in sort of an Elvis Presley, was the archetype that began it, was a kind of a tough man's game. And it was very much about sort of bravado, beating your chest, and, you know, a lot of male anger, youthful adolescent anger channeled into these great songs. I mean, you know, just listen to the Kinks' first five singles, you know, these sort of things. But then you had Brian Wilson, who was writing about himself being the one who needed to be consoled. Instead of him, pleading with a hysterical girlfriend, he's the one crying, and he's the one who is begging her to stay. He was always very sensitive and always very uncomfortably melancholy. From the earliest days. I mean, listen to In My Room. That can have connotations for an adolescent boy, but it's also a very strange song about loneliness and not being understood, as well as whatever you might think. But In My Room, there's a place I can go and tell my secrets to, in my room. This is not macho lyrics. And it was married to these verses, these melodies that were just so lush and beautiful and stunning, and he could do it without, and he could hear the harmonies with one ear without having ever been trained. One of the things that I find so fascinating that I've spoken about before, but the very fact that Brian Wilson had no training and could just continually pump out these classics, classic after classic after classic, and he does it year after year after year. I mean, their new thing is called 50 Greatest Hits. How many people have 50 greatest hits? Mm-hmm. All these songs charted, you know. You may not think you know them, but you probably know most all 50. Tony Asher, he's the guy that Brian, in a wonderfully ridiculous move, decided to bring in a complete stranger to write the lyrics for Pet Sounds, which is known as his masterpiece of a record. He had a history. He was writing songs with Mike Love, and then Mike only wanted to write about being true to your school and stuff, and so Brian was having his heart broken and wanted someone to express that, and he got a complete stranger because he liked a jingle that the guy had written on a radio. This is the sort of personality we're dealing with, and it's a beautiful thing, but it's crazy. Tony Asher says this. He said, for 4 hours, this is the creation of Pet Sounds, which is acknowledged as their masterpiece. For every four hours we'd spend writing songs, there'd be about 48 hours of these dopey conversations about some dumb book he'd just read. Or else he'd go on and on about girls, his feelings about this girl or that girl. It was just embarrassing, as well as exhibiting this awful, awful taste. His choice of movies was invariably terrible. TV programs, everything. He had a parrot statue when you walked into his house, which was the ugliest thing I'd ever seen. I do believe Brian is a musical genius. Absolutely. Whatever I thought about him personally was almost always overridden by my feelings of awe at what he was creating. I mean, he was able to create such extraordinary melodies. So this guy, this original heart on your sleeve man, was his gifts were so out of proportion with his own personal sophistication or givens, whatever, his background or whatever you have you. He was given something. And it was quite clear that he was given it. It wasn't earned, it wasn't deserved, it wasn't learned. He was given this thing, and it just came through him, and he couldn't account for it. Trying to hear Brian Wilson try to account for his talent, it's cute, but it makes no sense. And he never has come close to being able to explain what it is he does. He just says he hears things, and he starts playing at the piano, and these songs come out. But he is a real lesson in the power of weakness and vulnerability and judgment. I mean, he was also the product of an abusive childhood. It's his father, Murray Wilson, is known as like the original stage parent, like the first one. And you can hear he was very. Dave's talking about judgment and grace when it comes to parenting. Murray was so threatened by his son's talent. There's a recording on YouTube, you can hear it, of the recording session for Help Me Rhonda. And a drunken Murray, they've just fired him as their manager, a drunken Murray stumbles into the studio and tries to tell them what to do, and Brian's actually in charge of the session, and they're trying to be nice and not kick him out, and he starts going on and on over the tape. He said, Brian, I'm a genius too, you don't know what you're doing, you're not the only genius in this family. He says these things, it's for posterity, it's on YouTube, the poor guy. But he's a world-class jerk, and he was in competition with his son constantly. And so Brian, he came by his insecurity honestly. He talks about being beaten as a kid, but it doesn't sound like it was that bad. But, you don't want to relativize these things. It was just, and you don't want to, you don't want to put his mental problems at the feet of his father, but he certainly didn't help things that he had such an overbearing, difficult dad. The frequent allusion to male tears at that point, that would have been transgressive. His unconvincing attempts to beat his chest, the bravado. Those are the worst of the Beach Boys songs, but they're also the best, you know. But they're the worst because when you don't really believe it, when he's talking about, I don't back down. Now, Brian, you sound like exactly the type of guy that's going to back down, you know. You do not sound like the type of guy that will back down. But it's very hard not to have sympathy for this guy. And as a sort of sensitive young guy, when I talk about how I learned to stop worrying and love the Beach Boys, a lot of it has to do with sympathizing with this vulnerable soul who kind of couldn't help but be vulnerable. And it just kept coming out in his songs. I thought we would, and this ability or this inability not to, he couldn't censor himself. And this is one of the amazing things about Brian. He sort of didn't have a filter, even way back when. He would just start talking or start composing. And one of the things that I think just kind of comes with that kind of talent is that he wasn't censoring himself. There was that kind of creativity, you know, when you start second-guessing yourself a lot of times. Can someone crack a window? Or it is a window. But that ability to let himself be seen as weak over and over again is remarkable. And one of the great songs, of course, about this, which completely flips all of our thinking about popular music, at least thematically, on its head, and is also a perfect recording, is Don't Worry Baby. So we're going to listen to that. I think it's the finest example of their early style. This Listen to how insecure the opening couplet is. Song about drag racing now. You could listen to that song. I think it's one of my top three or four favorite songs ever. Even though he jumps the shark so completely in those second two verses. But who writes a song about this? Who says, it's been building up inside of me for I don't know how long. I don't know why, but I keep thinking something's bound to go wrong. That is, who can't relate to that? Although it was unfashionable, it's a beautiful sentiment. And to be married to that melody... It's just, and that production. He was aping Phil Spector. His idol was Phil Spector, who, you know, is in jail now. But Phil Spector is a bit of a genius himself. And Brian was such a sensitive person that he would, his obsession with Phil Spector when he was going through his most mental difficulties, he thought Phil Spector was out to kill him. And he actually hired people to follow Phil Spector. But his sort of ability to come to be himself and to communicate these things, his sort of inability not to, I find to be very beautiful and a real aspect of God's grace. Because I think that if God could work through Brian Wilson, or if he could use that broken of a vessel to produce that beautiful of a sound, then maybe he could work through me. Maybe he could do something with me. Now, a person who's that in touch, of course, with their vulnerabilities, with their brokenness, with their weakness, is also able to express gratitude and love to that same extent. And I think this is the great theme of the Beach Boys' music. It's not surfboards, and it's not, foot care, although they do have a great song about taking good care of your feet. They do. You name it, they've written about it. Or they've tried to sell it to you in a song just because they're interested in it. There's a great song of Brian's that called Help Is On The Way, where he tries to convince you to get into health food, and he is 300 pounds at the time. And running, he owned a store called the Radiant Radish in L.A., and he was known for sort of harassing the customers, and he got really into health food, but he was always eating cheeseburgers at the store. And there's a great picture, I think it's in one of those, where he's actually in a bathrobe at the Radiant Radish. It didn't take off. The store didn't take off. But Brian, this is what he was like. But the greatest song, I think, about gratitude that's really ever been written in the American pop idiom is God Only Knows. And I thought we have to go there, because that is... If you're interested in religion and culture, that is the first time, in sort of top 40 radio in the 60s that God was ever used in the title of a song that charted. And they were very nervous about that. And Brian actually, this is interesting, Brian said this last year about what happened when he was trying to write, this is how he understands what he was doing. And I think there's real truth in this, actually. But this is, by the way, a 70-year-old Brian Wilson talking about what a 23-year-old Brian Wilson was doing. Carl, that's Carl Wilson, who sang the song. Carl and I kept praying for the highest love to bring to people. We all in the band believe in Jesus, and we believe in God, and we believe that we were his messengers. So we followed through with our career as his messengers in the world. And that's how we did it. Spirituality is love, right? Love and spirituality are kind of like the same, but spirituality is like everlasting love. That's what he says. He says music is God's voice. I've often felt that I was on a musical mission to spread the gospel of love through records. That sounds cheesy and Californian, but then listen to God Only Knows. And this is not the version you know from Big Love and whatever. This is the version, this is from a private rehearsal in 1967 when Brian, who was so anxious that he had to stop touring with the band in 1964, he came back for a show and was directing them in the studio, and they recorded it for a show in Hawaii that they never ended up doing. Here we go. It's minimal. That's Brian. Brian's the high part always. It's the falsetto. Stoned, but like so beautiful, and that vocal tag at the end, that's all, everything. Brian did the whole thing. He didn't write the lyrics, the stranger did, but he told him what to say, and he wanted him to say it. And so Brian is this wonderful lesson in the fact that vulnerability and weakness is actually the birthplace of connection. To connect with another person is to be vulnerable. We all know that, to be fully known and fully loved is what Matt was talking about, but it's the birthplace of real love and connection is weakness. And Brian's was writing these, in one sense, they were these magnificent songs of the highest quality in this kind of particular medium, but they were also about weakness and loneliness and insecurity and sadness. And he was under tremendous pressure. This is a really interesting thing about why people aren't more vulnerable, why people aren't more willingness to be like Brian. Brian had this compulsion to do it, and maybe you do too, to be confessional and wear your heart on your sleeve. But why do people not? Why are they not like this? Well, he experienced why they're not like this. Because one of the we're not like this because we're afraid. fear is the reason we're not as forthcoming about what's really going on inside. And Brian, after Pet Sounds, he did a song called Good Vibrations, which you all know, and that was called is this beautiful teenage symphony, and it was the longest time and most amount of money ever spent on a single song. And listen to it again with fresh ears, because there's about five distinct movements in that song. It's pretty phenomenal. But he started on this record called Smile, which maybe you've heard. It's been in the news the last couple of years. And it was to be this very slightly avant-garde. He really wanted to take things further. He was interested in making something that was truly American. He was interested in Charles Ives, that composer. He was wanted to write, in Brian Wilson fashion, he wanted to write a song, an album that was about food, humor, the American West, and the railroads, I think. I mean, it was a lot of different things. But there was a Western motif running through. And there was like, and then the elements. So those water, fire, air, and wind. Or, sorry, what's the other, the wood, rock. I don't know. Captain Planet, help me. And what happened was he was writing these songs, and the Beach Boys were touring, and they were having to sell the stuff. And they came back and were not into what he was doing. It was gone a little too far. And to be totally honest, Brian was into some very strong, narcotics, and it was a fragile makeup to begin with. And LSD basically fried him for pretty significantly for a while. And but he experienced an enormous amount of judgment when they came back, and they resisted. All of them resisted this new music. And what happened was Brian was so defeated by this, and he was already battling eternal amounts of law and pressure to better Pet Sounds and to do better than Good Vibrations, which had been a number one single. He was in competition with Phil Spector in his mind, and most importantly with the Beatles. But he was one guy. He was obsessed with the Beatles. And when Paul McCartney commonly says that Revolver came out, and then the Beach Boys put out Pet Sounds, and that inspired Paul McCartney to try to better it by doing Sgt. Pepper's. And this Smile was his attempt to sort of deal with Sgt. Pepper. But when that came out, it was such a he took it as such a condemnation or such a raising of the bar. And he was so afraid, coupled with the enormous amounts of pressure he was getting from his family, because these weren't just his band members, there was a family. And internally, he was fragile. He had a total nervous breakdown. And if you know that Brian Wilson in 1967 retreated to his room for essentially 15 years. And how I like to say that is that he couldn't wall himself off emotionally, so he had to wall himself off physically. And maybe you know people like this. Maybe you're like this. But he had to get away. He had to get away. And for Brian, actually, what's even more interesting is not only was he shackled with this term genius, by the way, that was used to sell records early on. Brian Wilson is a genius. And so he's like, oh, I've got everything I've got to do has got to be a genius thing. He was also Smile. He abandoned it. And they put out a record called Smiley Smile, which they said that Smile was a grand slam, and the guys at the time said Smiley Smile is more like a bunt. If you listen to it, they'll start cracking up in the middle of songs. It's a very trippy record, and I think they recorded it one weekend away, clearly intoxicated. But it's a very strange record, and these were these guys that were like wearing pinstripes, and people thought they were all about fun in the sun, and they were writing this very strange music about male baldness. And there's a song called She's Going Bald on that record, which is they start laughing in the middle of it. Anyway, Brian, anytime Smile took on this mythic status, because of course not only did it represent to him personal failure, it started to represent to the entire world, or at least the music world, as this lost masterpiece, as this thing that was going to be so good that no one would be able to ever top it. So Smile to him, represented failure and judgment, because he'd never been in. And little pieces of Smile kept coming out on records, because Brian was upstairs in bed and the Beach Boys needed a new product for their records, and so they'd say, hey, let's take that song from Smile and put it on here. And they did that successfully with a number of songs, and they were incredible. But it just fed it perpetuated this law that he was living under that was exacerbated by all these other dynamics. So when, you know, the Romans, we say the law brings wrath. That's what happened with Brian Wilson. The law, the pressure, had an enormous amount of negative consequences on his internal life and therefore on the music. But of course, because Brian was so preternaturally gifted, the melodies, the beauty, just kept seeping out of him. It wouldn't stop. And so he'd go down. There's all sorts of stories about Brian in the years from 1967 to basically 1972, where he would just come down in the middle. They built a recording session in his recording studio in his house to try to get him to contribute more, but he was upstairs, you know, sleeping, and other stuff. I mean, I don't want to. There's a real temptation to make Brian Wilson into some the straight man's Judy Garland. You know, like he's a contributor to his problems too. He's not an innocent. So he's a really screwed up guy. And if you look at the things he's done, he's not been innocent. But Brian would come down. He'd be hearing them play, and he'd come down, say, "No, these five things need to happen. This harmony there, and then go upstairs." And that would be the best song on the record because he gave it 30 seconds. But he also, within L.A., he was sort of starting to be seen as this washed-up, drugged-out, extremely large man. He was up to, if you look at those pictures, there's one picture of him in 1976 where he's 350 pounds. And but these guys were all sort of, they needed him. They needed him for, you know what, before we go any further, I'm going to play you a song off Smile. How about that? Surf's Up. You guys know the song Surf's Up? Anyone know it? Mm-hmm. It's what he referred to as the masterpiece of the record, and just so you know, I never realized what it was really about. But it is about God. He called Smile a teenage symphony to God, and he talks about this song being about hearing the word of God, and that basically the word of God is a children's song, and there's something about the inner child. I don't quite understand it, but it's beautiful. And the idea that God is in the ocean and stuff like that, and Surf's Up, of course, dovetails nicely. A diamond necklace played the pawn, in an answer from the gone world to an end of time. This is Carl singing. A blind man's aristocracy, back through the opera glass, you see, appeared in the page of the
choke of grief, heart, heart, and I be surf's up. What a tidal wave. Come about heart and join the young and often spring you came. I heard the word, wonderful thing, a children's
Leonard Bernstein, the composer of West Side Story and the great American composer, he featured that on a television show in 1967. And that was a recording that Brian did solo at the piano of him singing. And the Beach Boys were so desperate for product. Or they weren't that desperate for product, actually. They've got more unreleased stuff than anyone on earth. But they loved that song so much they wanted it to come out, so they took it and they reconstructed it. And they used that demo of him playing at the piano, which is so beautiful. And this is one of my favorite things that encapsulates all of Brian Wilson, and it encapsulates the human condition and the beauty and absurdity of life and God's grace and the joy of humor. This is an explanation he gave about that song. And this is this was what the article, the guy wrote. He said, I heard the word of God, wonderful thing. That's the joy of enlightenment, of seeing God. What is it? A children's song. And then there's the song itself, the song of children, the song of the universe rising and falling in wave after wave, the song of God, hiding the love from us but always letting us find it again, like a mother singing to her children. That's that final vocal tag about child as the father of the man. The record was over. Wilson went into the kitchen and squirted Ready Whip direct from the can into his mouth, made himself a great chocolate shake, and ate a couple of candy bars. Isn't that beautiful? How can you not love this man? He's capable of such great beauty, and he's such a moron, and a child himself, but producing music that will last, I think. I think some of his music will really last. And so it's just so out of proportion. And so, therefore, beautiful and awe-inspiring, the story of Brian. I've only made it up through Smile in 1970, and I can give you a brief. By the way, the reason I originally got into the Beach Boys was my father, who's here, bought me a couple of best ofs of the Beach Boys on record, on LP, when I was a kid. And they were very interesting, but one of them was just sort of the standard stuff that you get, the Surfin' USA, maybe Warmth of the Sun was on there, Surfer Girl, but it was all pretty much the car and surf songs. And then we got another one, which is long out of print, but it had a song called Vegetables on it, and that's one of the Smile songs that was reconstructed, and it was a song about eating vegetables, and it's talking about eating carrots. And there was a sound of a carrot being, you know, Paul McCartney famously provided the sound of a carrot being snapped. And people think that vegetables was a metaphor for drugs, and it probably was, but I don't think they were that cognizant of what was going on to even think on those terms. But it was such a strange song. It was so weird and so unlike anything. I knew at the age of 9 that something was going on with this band that I had to know more about when I heard the song Vegetables. I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetables. If I had a big brown bag of them all, I'd jump up and down and ask for a carrot. Like, those are the lyrics. I'm repeating the lyrics. I know all of them. And this is the joy of the Beach Boys. So it's a lesson in judgment. It's a lesson in vulnerability. And Brian was sort of kind of inactive. But a wonderful thing happened when Brian went inactive. And this is a sort of a Grace Law thing, too. His brother started producing records, who had not had any, they'd only been around him. but they had felt so that they couldn't compete with Brian, so it took him leaving the scene completely for them to start creating. And it turned out they had enormous talent of their own. And so there's the second phase of the Beach Boys begins in the third phase probably begins in 1968. And that's when Dennis and Carl, and even Al and Mike, are doing these amazing things. And in 1972, the Beach Boys toured with the Grateful Dead. And, you know, they were all these bearded wackos. But this music was incredible. And they were voted, like, the best live band in America by Rolling Stone, which was very hip then. But people forget this. They went and recorded an album in Holland. They had two black guys in the band for 3 years. And those songs were great. And I thought I'd play one of my favorite songs from that era, which also encapsulates the vulnerability thing. It's a title that Brian definitely made up. This was not someone writing this title. It's called "You Need a Mess of Help to Stand Alone." You need a mess of help to stand alone. Now, this is their period. They had two South African musicians in the band, so they had a little bit of soul. They were playing kind of like country, funk, pop, weird stuff, and it's great. I think it's the most incredible period of their. But it's all about Brian needing relief from the pressures and the sickness inside of him and dying for some help. And in fact, the place he resorts to is God and belief in the end. But you wouldn't know that because you won't be able to understand any of the lyrics.
Oh, wait.
I hope I haven't lost you guys yet. I know it's warm in here. I need 73. Vocal breakdown. Begin now. Wait, not now. Two more bars. But lots of banjo and violin. Beautiful, joyful music talking about the chorus is, the first chorus is, "Relief, I cried. Ain't no shuck and jive. I need a mess of help to stand alone." Next chorus, this is a man who's been in bed and is very depressed and troubled. But he's writing music like this, but what the lyrics say is, "Please realize I'm not half alive without a mess of help to stand alone." And the last verse is, the last chorus is, "Belief, I cried. Ain't no shuck and jive. I need a mess of help to stand alone." I mean, that's incredible stuff, I think. And that's on a song. That's on a record that no one bought. No one listened to. It's called Carl and the Passions. It's a schizophrenic record, but there are a schizophrenic band. Meaning, like, one of the marks I think of genius is not that they continue to create solid records. I've always felt the true mark of genius is that they create records that are terrible and extremely good. meaning like they do things in extremes, and the Beach Boys did things in extremes. I mean, when they decided to write an album called Holland, they moved to Holland and recorded a record. You don't think of Holland when you think of the Beach Boys, but they moved to Holland and they wrote a record. When they decide to do a spoken word song, it's like 10 minutes long. It's terrible, but it's also incredible. When they commit to an idea, when they want to do a disco song, they put a 12-minute disco song on their L.A. record, which is from 1978, which is other. I mean, it's actually an incredible disco song, but let's just say it alienated their fan base. They didn't like it. They write their songs about very specific things. So if the joke is that, you know, if they write a song called Add Some Music to Your Day, it's about practically all the ways that you could add music to your day. Like if you're sitting in a dentist chair, they have music for you there. Or if you're, you know, walking by a church, you might be able to hear some music that way. There's a song that's called Anna Lee the Healer. It's about a massage woman named Anna Lee who they talked about she gets great massages. It's actually not sexual. There's a song called Take a Load Off Your Feet, as I mentioned earlier, and it's about taking good care of your feet and watching if you're walking in grass, watch out, there might be some glass. Like, these are the lyrics they came up with. But then on the same record, they would have a song that's I'm a cork on the ocean floating over the raging sea. How deep is the ocean? I lost my way. Like, incredible moments of profundity next to totally asinine. like the dumbest possible thing you could imagine. And that's what makes them so fascinating, because they're no more absurd than life itself. But to have all this encapsulated in one group was just unbelievable. And then for you to tell people that you like the Beach Boys and they're constantly accusing you of being a nerd because that's the squarest of the square, when you know these were the weirdest of the weird, you know that they were pioneering all the music, actually, that they're copied now today by their different periods of the Beach Boys has spawned genres. You know, genres of music, and I'm not lying about that. It's unbelievable the amount of stuff that they did. Do they have some rap songs in their history? Yes, they've got three. One's called Smart Girls. One's called Surfing in the USA, not Surfing USA. And they're both those two are the ones that I'm thinking of. I think there's one other demo, but they're terrible. But they did rap songs. Because they're the Beach Boys, and they're insane. So when the Beach Boys, you know, wanted to litigate, they did it for 20 solid years. And when they wanted to, like, sue each other, they just kept suing, and then they would just record records. And, like, they're notoriously litigious. They're, like, the most litigious band in history. I'm sure that there's going to be new lawsuits after a result of this record, because they're crazy. But, again, craziness, weakness, out of that, issues forth this beautiful love and vulnerability and power. The music has power. Let me think. What else do I want to say? I'm trying to sum up all my thoughts on the Beach Boys, and that's really overwhelming for me. So a lot of this is like I've taken like 10 different things I've done on Mockingbird and tried to squish them together. The Beach Boys, you know, when we talk about the human condition being that Christians believe that we are created in the image of God, so there's something beautiful, but we are totally fallen, that we are sinful. And the Beach Boys are evidence of that, because, you know, the idea that we are our own worst enemies, you and I are our own worst enemies, doesn't mean there's not evil out there and problems to be solved, but the Beach Boys are their own worst enemies. Like, they actually are their own worst enemies. When I say that, I'm not being, like, figurative. They have kept their best material in the vault out of spite for one another. They have screwed each other over in every imagined possible way. And yet they somehow still have, we all know them. We all know these people. And you know what, what else can I say about that? So what happened in the late 70s, you ask? Well, in the late 70s, they tried to get Brian out of bed. What happened? There was a compilation called Endless Summer that came out in 1975, and it went gold, and it sold, like, you know, 500,000 copies in a week, because there was nostalgia from the early 60s. It was, you know, when they say 12-year periods, right? Or 22-year periods, I forget which. But there were people being nostalgic for that era, and it sold a ton. So basically, the artistic side of the band got kind of squashed for a little while, and they started trying to do more of the Fun in the Sun stuff. The problem being that they were now in their 40s, and it was creepy. But just even look at the cover of their record from 1976 called 15 Big Ones. The dumbest name for a record ever. If they're going to name it record poorly, they're going to name it really poorly, you know? It's got Brian is got Jesus hair, a beard, and he's wearing a muumuu. And he looks like about 350 pounds, and I think, you know, Mike Love looks like he's on the Love Boat. And it's so bad, but so it's basically men in their 40s trying to make the same music they made in their 20s, and therefore it's actually really interesting, because they're using keyboards. And Brian got obsessed with a keyboard sound that sounded like flatulence. That's what it sounded like. And they did a whole record in 1978 called The Beach Boys Love You, which was an attempt to get Brian again back into the studio. And everything he would do would be have some shred of his genius in it, because he couldn't shut off that. Whatever there was, he couldn't shut it off. He was powerless over his talent, but it also he suffered because of it, and it was this combination of the exquisitely sublimely beautiful, next to a song about Johnny Carson, like, and specifically about Johnny. That's the thing about the Beach Boys. If the title tells you what the song's about, Johnny Carson. I love that Johnny Carson. He gives it his all every night. That's a lyrics in the song. It makes you want to cry. How good he is on that show. Like that. I'm not kidding. It moves into tears. And then the same record's got a song called Solar System. What's it about? The solar system. It's like every single planet is gone through. There's the line, the famous line: "If Mars had life on it, I might find a wife on it." This stuff was being put out. They put this stuff out. And they were sitting on a mountain of incredible stuff, too. So it's this constant, like, both and, simul justus et peccator, kind of, the entire warp and woof of human history, I think, is combined in these guys. And the jealousies of being siblings, but the irrepressible love and loyalty and blind loyalties of family, combined with the sort of pettiness of life and this supreme beauty coming through despite their efforts to all their efforts to sort of quench it. And that's really interesting to me. And so that's what happened in the 70s and 80s. Brian sort of slowly got out of his funk, but of course by the time he was 1988, he not only got skinny, he got skinnier than he'd ever been in his whole life. He looked like rail thin. And in order to get Brian Wilson well, they had to hire a psychologist who was insane himself, named Eugene Landy, and he and three guys were around him 24/7 for 3 years. And you read interviews from this period where if the guy's not there in the interview, Brian will ask the interviewer on the record for drugs. Like, that's what Brian Wilson is like. That's his inability to censor himself. But then he'll also talk with extreme vulnerability about the hurts he felt from his brothers and his cousins and his love for music. So it's, I'm trying to think if there's anything else I really want to say, because I would like to go to listen to some stuff from the very like present day. We all know Kokomo, right? Mm-hmm. That happened in what, 88, 89? Full House, you know, that stuff happened. That was, Brian was no longer, Brian, they scored a number one hit without Brian Wilson in the band. And he was deeply scarred by that. And again, this man who was so vulnerable, it just kind of set him back tremendously. But then you have, in the last 10 years, he actually completed Smile, which was seen as an enormous, and it was, an enormous, courageous thing for him to do. This thing that embodied failure and judgment and rejection, he was able to go back to and complete. And it's a beautiful piece of music. And they put out the original tapes of it last year. Then the Beach Boys, of course, reunited this past year for a tour and an album called That's Why God Made the Radio. It's actually a nicely vertical record, and it's very sad. And, like everything Beach Boys related, it has gone up in flames. So this past week, you know, that news came out. So I thought we would talk about, I think, one of the great songs that, because we're really out of time, that we are out of time, but this, we're going to end with this following song, which I think came out, 5 years ago, called Midnight's Another Day. It was off of that Lucky Old Sun record. And when we talk about strength and weakness, when we talk about when I'm weak, I'm strong, when we talk about God's light shining in the dark places, what better imagery is there than Midnight's Another Day? And this is Brian. This is a personal song. This is, and I think it's the last, probably the last great song he's written. But it was written, you know, only 5 years ago. And it's called Midnight's Another Day. His voice has been ravaged, you know, by the way he lived. Obligatory vocal breakdown. That's what septuagenarian music sounds like. Well, last song as you guys leave is called Love and Mercy. It's the song, sort of his signature tune at this point. Is a man singing about what we all need is love and mercy. And I've got the CD single. It's hanging above my office in over there in the Christ Church, because I think it's such a powerful and authentic Christian song, and compassionate song. You can listen, you can go. 7 p.m. is dinner. Thanks for listening to me.